Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 18, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will hear the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau update for April 2017. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us the Honorable Wayne A. Abernathy, Executive Vice President for Financial Institutions Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the American Bankers Association, and Julius L. Lozier of Counsel at Winston & Strawn, LLP. I will turn it over to Wayne Abernathy to get started. After opening remarks, we will go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Wayne. The floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much, and welcome everybody on our call today. It's a pleasure to be able to discuss with you some of the latest developments at the Consumer Bureau. And today we will, Jerry Lozier, who is of counsel at Winston & Strawn, and myself, Wayne Abernathy from American Bankers Association. What we hope to do is go through this wonderful outline that Jerry Lozier puts together every month of significant developments involving the Consumer Bureau. We have some 24 items that we could draw from. That's certainly more than we could address in the 1 hour that we have. So Jerry and I have selected what we think are some of the key issues to raise with you. We will spend a few minutes going over those particular points, and then we'll shift the time to all of you who are listening in, where you can call, you can ask us questions about some of the issues we've discussed or about some of the issues we didn't discuss but that are of interest to you, and we'd be happy to talk about those as well. The 24 items that Jerry has gathered together run through April 11, so we won't have anything necessarily that's happened in the last couple of days, but certainly we could discuss them if that's of particular interest to any of you on the call. So with that, let me turn the time over to Jerry Lozier, who will go through the rundown of the issues that we want to talk about and then take up the first issue. Go ahead, Jerry.
Thank you very much, Wayne. We're going to talk about a dozen issues today, maybe even more than that, actually, because there's been a lot of interesting things to talk about. First of all, we're going to talk about developments in the PHH case, and then the president's executive order on reorganization and how it could theoretically affect the CFPB, inspector general reports on some of the practices at the CFPB, the Bureau's review of certain of its rules, North Dakota court case in which the CFPB lost, the ongoing debate about the how the CFPB might be reformed, and also about a Washington Legal Foundation petition for cert that's pending in the Supreme Court against the CFPB. And if we have enough time, we're going to touch on a letter that a Missouri congressman wrote the CFPB alleging racial discrimination in small business lending, the monthly complaint report that the CFPB issues, an article about some of the CFPB's marketing expenses and how its staff has voted in, made campaign contributions. And then I would talk briefly about an enforcement action the CFPB took against a credit reporting agency, and then also about the position that the CFPB takes on the statute of limitations. With all that said, let me turn to the first item, i.e. the PHH case. This covers about five developments that happened this last month, because there were a lot of things that happened with this case. By way of background, Wayne, I hope it's okay if I take a couple of minutes just to explain the background of this case, because I think it'll make the developments clearer their significance if people understand the background. And for those of you who know the background very well, I apologize for going over well-trodden ground here. But the background of this case is it arises under the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, RESPA. RESPA prohibits essentially the payment of kickbacks in connection with a residential mortgage transactions. Before the CFPB was created, authority for enforcing RESPA was in the hands of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And for many, many years, I want to say 18 years at least, the CFPB had on its books an interpretation under RESPA that when a mortgage insurance company makes a payment of a reinsurance premium to a company that is affiliated with a mortgage lender, that does not constitute a kickback. And it's a not uncommon practice in the insurance business for insurance companies to reinsure the risk with other insurance companies. And so that's sort of the practice here. They pay a premium to the other insurance company for that agreement by the other insurance company to reinsure the risk. And so theoretically, well, and as a matter of fact, some mortgage companies have insurance affiliates that reinsure those types of premiums. And HUD had long taken the position that those premium payments for reinsurance did not constitute a kickback to the lender. And PHH, which is one of the leading mortgage companies in the country, had such an arrangement. The CFPB sued PHH for that arrangement, and the administrative law judge fined PHH $6 million. PHH appealed the case to the director of the CFPB, who ruled that the statute of limitations does not apply in the case of administrative enforcement actions, and increased the fine from $6 million to more than $100 million. PHH then appealed the case to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, and last October, a three-judge panel of that court ruled that the structure of the CFPB is unconstitutional because the director of the CFPB cannot be removed by the president other than for cause. He cannot be removed at will by the president, and therefore the court felt that was a violation of separation of powers, and that the president under Article 2 cannot enforce the laws if he doesn't have the right to remove an official. There are court cases that say that it is not unconstitutional for the president to only be able to remove an agency member for cause, but the D.C. Circuit three-judge panel suggested that in the case of these multiple member agencies, the amount of power and discretion that's exercisable by a single member is offset by the power of other members on the commission. But in the case of the CFPB, there's just a single director, and that was the constitutional flaw there. CFPB requested the D.C. Circuit to rehear the case en banc, the entire panel of judges, and the D.C. Circuit granted that request, and so there will be oral argument on that case on May 24th. With that background, the five developments are as follows in this last month. First of all, PHH filed its initial brief, and the brief urged the court not to dodge the constitutional question by simply ruling on the merits of the RESPA issue, because if the court did just rule on the merits of the RESPA issue and sent the case back to the CFPB, it would be remanding the case to an unconstitutional agency. Also addressed in the brief is an issue that the court asked PHH and the CFPB to brief, and it's a totally unrelated issue. There is a currently pending in the D.C. Circuit, there is a separate independent case involving the constitutionality of administrative law judges used by the SEC. And so the D.C. Circuit asked PHH and the CFPB to brief that issue, the constitutionality of ALJs. And coincidentally, that separate case involving the SEC will be argued on May 24th, the same day as the oral argument in our PHH case. So PHH, in its brief, argues that please do not avoid the CFPB constitutional structure issue by simply ruling that the ALJs are unconstitutional and referring the matter back to a constitutional ALJ appointed by the CFPB, because then what would happen, you'd have a constitutionally appointed ALJ ruling on a notice of charges that was issued by an unconstitutional agency. Bottom line, the PHH argues that the entire CFPB should shut down. That's to be contrasted. The three-judge panel had not shut down the CFPB. It said the remedy for the unconstitutionality is to grant the president the right to remove the director for cause. The second development that happened is the Department of Justice last month filed an amicus brief in the case, and instead of supporting the federal agency, the CFPB, it opposed the CFPB. It did not support the CFPB, and it argued that the CFPB structure is unconstitutional, but it further argues that there is no need to shut down the CFPB, that the proper remedy is for the court to affirm the three-judge panel view that the president under the Constitution has the authority to remove the director of the CFPB at will. Third development concerning the PHH case is that the House Financial Services Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations held a hearing on the constitutionality of the CFPB last month, and one of its witnesses was Ted Olson, the lawyer for PHH in the PHH case, and the reaction of the Democrats was that the Republicans are siding with a mortgage company that has been accused of fraud, and it's, quote, a disgrace, unquote, to hold that hearing. Development number four, current and former members of Congress filed an amicus brief on March 31, and those former members of Congress included former U.S. Senator Chris Dodd and former Representative Barney Frank, the Dodd-Frank pair. They were represented by the Constitutional Accountability Center, which suggested that the CFPB needed two attributes. It needed to be independent, and it needed to have the ability to act quickly, and that a structure of a single director, not removable for policy differences, it was the only structure that would meet that need. The brief argues the Constitution authorizes Congress to make all laws necessary for carrying into execution all powers of the federal government, and therefore it argues the Congress has to have the flexibility to structure government to respond effectively to new challenges, and it argues that restricting the president's removal authority does not impede his ability to perform his constitutional duties. And the last development on this case last month was that the CFPB filed its brief case, and interestingly, the brief acknowledges that the structure of the CFPB is not traditional, and because it's a single member agency, but the brief just cites the traditional structure case law regarding multi-member agencies as the basis for upholding the structure. So we'll have to wait till next month to see how the oral argument goes. Wayne, how about President Trump's reorganization executive orders?
Thank you, Jerry. Very much want to dive into that. If I could just make one comment, though, on this PHH case, it's just so interesting. I, as you know, there is some concern that the en banc decision, once they came to a decision, could be similar to what one of the judges of the three-judge panel was, which is to make a finding based solely on the statutory issues and not go to the constitutional point about whether the way the Bureau is set up or not meets constitutional tests, the argument being that the law itself is clear enough to be able to resolve this particular case. And I thought what was interesting about that is that it appears that the Bureau, in their filing, in their written filing, they're urging the court to decide on the constitutional questions. I think on the argument that these questions keep being raised so frequently, they would like to have some finality from a court decision dealing with them. I thought that was very interesting.
That is interesting.
So let me jump into item number two here, which is an executive order by President Trump issued on March 13, dealing with a comprehensive plan for reorganizing the executive branch. This is a mandate given to all of the executive branch agencies to look at how they're structured and to reconsider their organization and see if there are ways to eliminate unnecessary components of the agencies, duties, structures, programs, maybe even the agency itself. And directs the head of each agency after a 180-day period, started on March 13, to report back to the OMB director what the agency's findings are. And then the OMB director puts together all of that input and comes up with an overall plan for how to slim down, presumably, the federal government of the United States, which is one of the important promises that the president made in the campaign of wanting to reduce the size of government. One of the very interesting things about this is that unlike some of the other executive orders dealing with some of the financial services issues and governmental organizational issues, this one seems to be very explicitly designed to include every single agency. Some of the earlier ones, it was clear, for example, on the freeze on employment and so forth, there was the general view that those orders did not apply to independent agencies like the banking regulators. It would apply to the departments and the bureaus of the departments, but not to the independent financial agencies, such as the Bureau, for example, as well as the Federal Reserve and some of the others. This particular order, though, does seem, in its terms, to reach out to every single agency that is part of the executive branch. No word yet on how the Bureau is going to react to this, because in the past, I think the Bureau felt, well, doesn't touch us, we'll continue to go on as we are. And this one in particular will be a test to see to what extent the Bureau is willing to take orders from an executive decision by the president and follow what those orders instruct him to do. Interesting to see how that plays out. Back to you, Jerry, for the next item.
Okay, thanks, Wayne. I was going to talk about the Inspector General reports on some of the vendor contracts at the CFPB. There were two reports last month on vendor contracts. The first addressed conflicts of interest, and it was sort of surprising what the report disclosed. It turns out that the CFPB hires a third-party vendor to analyze potential racial discrimination in lending by individual companies. And the vendor that the CFPB hired apparently also works for firms that are supervised by the CFPB, including a firm, one of the firms that it was asked to analyze. So, and it turns out that the vendor did not disclose the conflict of interest that it was in to the CFPB for two full years. In the final analysis, the vendor ended up not performing the work under that contract, but it's extraordinary that something like that could happen. The other IG report about vendors questioned some of the controls that the CFPB has on what they call sole source contracts, contracts that do not go out for bid. And the IG examined what the CFPB does to ensure that the price it is paying, essentially on the no-bid contract, is reasonable. And it turns out, in some cases, the CFPB thought the price was reasonable because based solely on information provided by the third-party vendor to the CFPB. And in other cases, the reasonableness of the price was based on publicly available rates that were not really independently verified by the CFPB, or on government contract awards that were never even identified by the CFPB. So obviously a need for improvement in the internal controls over at the CFPB. Wayne, how about reviews, the CFPB's reviews of some of its rules?
Well, this kind of it certainly piggybacks, even if the Bureau doesn't acknowledge necessarily that the executive order from the president to review regulations and how they apply directly applies to the Bureau. Nevertheless, the Bureau has undertaken a series of regulatory review exercises in recent days. And first of them begins with an announcement by the Bureau's Associate Director for Supervision, Christy Angelo. I moderated a panel at a recent meeting here in town, and Chris, when he was on that panel, mentioned that the Bureau is taking up and what they consider to be their responsibility to review a variety of regulations, certainly what they call its major rules, to assess how those regulations are playing out, what effects they're having on the markets. They believe that's mandated by the Dodd-Frank Act, which does require the Bureau to take a review every 5 years. So I thought that was very important that they're taking that up in earnest. And then some of the recent actions following that suggest that they really are digging into a number of these rules. Ones that I'd point to is on March 24th, just 3 days later, the Bureau published a request for information regarding its remittance rule. You might recall that was the very first regulatory rule that the Bureau put in place in complying with the Dodd-Frank Act, which ordered the Bureau to take a look at the practices with regard to remittances, particularly foreign remittances, and instructed the Bureau to provide new regulations addressing those practices in a number of different ways. And the Bureau did so, came out with a rule, which they then, after making the rule final, made some additional changes. And then on the 24th, the Bureau published a request for information saying, how are we doing? How is the rule going? What is the impact? How is it? What has its effect been on the remittance business and on consumers who rely upon remittances? So that was one item in particular that they stepped into. And then shortly thereafter, on the 28th of March, the Bureau proposed an amendment to Regulation B under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, ECOA, with regard to the collection of information by creditors with regard to sex, race of certain mortgage applicants, and so forth. And they say the intent is of this rule change that they're proposing to reconcile differences between Reg B under ECOA and new requirements under the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, or HMDA, where the Dodd-Frank Act expanded the categories of information to be gathered under HMDA. And then the Bureau implemented that and then added a few more categories and then came to the recognition that what they were asking for in HMDA didn't fit with what they were denied to have access to under ECOA. And so they're proposing an amendment to Regulatory B of ECOA to reconcile those two differences. And then in an additional change that the Bureau entered into in recent days, it deals with their prepaid card rule. On April 1, changes to the prepaid card rule that went final on October 1 of last year, they pushed an additional six-month delay in the effective date of the prepaid card rule to allow an opportunity for making some further adjustments. And one of the key points in their particular rule and their proposal is that there still remains a significant problem, and we hope to raise that in connection with this review by the Bureau, and that is in defining a prepaid card, the Bureau's language in the regulation would seem to also include deposit products, any kind of a deposit, and bringing deposit accounts under the terms of the prepaid card rule doesn't fit very well, particularly checking accounts, the deposits that are tied to checking accounts. They would bring the checking accounts into the prepaid card rule, and that could create some very significant inconsistencies. And so we're hoping the Bureau will then use the time of extending the implementation date to review those problems as it has done with some of the other rules. I would note that a lot of the rules that the Bureau does, after they make them final, they do listen to implementation issues and will often go back and then make changes afterwards. But that's a little bit different from many of the regulatory agencies, which will make a lot of these changes prior to finalizing the rule. The Bureau, when it publishes a rule for comment and the final rule, normally there isn't a whole lot of difference between the two, but then changes are made after they finalize the proposal here, and that can cause some significant implementation issues, but that does seem to be the pattern that the Bureau is following, I guess better than not fixing problems that arise in implementation. Back to you, Jerry.
Thank you, Wayne. I just wanted to talk for a minute about the Interceptor Corporation case. This was a case in which the CFPB sued a payment processor, all of whose customers are merchants. and who had no consumers as customers, but the merchant customers of the payment processor would authorize it to charge accounts held by consumers. The U.S. District Court for North Dakota dismissed the case that the CFPB brought, and one might have hoped that the basis for the dismissal would have been that the CFPB did not have jurisdiction over a company that did not deal with consumers, but that was not the basis for the dismissal. The basis for the dismissal was the unique to that case fact that the CFPB did not allege sufficiently detailed facts to suggest that the payment processor had violated the law. The CFPB had asserted in its complaint that the payment processor had disregarded, quote, red flags, unquote, but it did not identify what the red flags were or explain how disregarding those red flags would have hurt consumers, and so the case was dismissed. Wayne, how about the debate about single director versus commission at the structure of the CFPB?
Yeah, thank you, Jerry. This is a very interesting debate because it's constantly changing. One of the most significant developments, I would say, is as we've seen in the press in recent weeks, there seems to be a debate among some of the Democrats about whether or not the structure of the Bureau ought to be changed. As a reminder, the Consumer Bureau is headed by a sole director. That is the only individual that is appointed with the advice and consent of the Senate, appointed by the President. There is no other peer that the Bureau director has. It's a he is the consumer's czar, the consumer protection czar, and it was intended that way. The argument being that that would increase the efficiency of the work being done by the Consumer Bureau. But there's not much in the way of checks and balances, hence the discussion that Jerry began with regard to the PHH case. Well, now that the appointment of the head of the Bureau shifts to a Republican president, there's some concern on the part of some of the Democrat congressmen of what happens to the Bureau if it's headed by someone appointed by a Republican president who may have a very different view of what they want the Bureau to do, how it should be run, and so forth. And at least some Democrat congressmen are suggesting maybe it is a good idea to have the Bureau run by a commission, because with a commission, changes have to be made at least in consultation with other officials who are appointed by the president and who have some say in what the decisions are done. We have, for example, Congressman Brad Sherman of California is very concerned about what happens when you have a Republican director with the broad authorities that Richard Cordray currently has. Another Congressman, John Delaney of Maryland, has indicated he would support a commission if Director Cordray were on the commission, and that the commission does not go into effect until a majority of its members have actually been confirmed by the Senate. On the other hand, you do have other Democrats who are happy with the current structure of the commission. Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts gave the opinion that she believed that commissions are not effective. Ranking Democrat on the House Financial Services Committee, Maxine Waters, has expressed her concern that commissions can become deadlocked, and that in that process might slow down actions that could be taken. And then Congressman Capuano, also on the Financial Services Committee, Democrat of Massachusetts, has expressed some suspicion that all the folks who are talking about wanting to have a commission are folks who don't like the Bureau anyway. And so he suspects there might be something behind those efforts really to stifle the ability of the Bureau to do what it was intended to do. Now, just to point out that these changing views and a variety of views aren't limited to the Democrats, the Republicans in the House Financial Services Committee have also been changing their views of where they want to go. In a bill that was proposed last year in the House Financial Services Committee, Chairman Jeb Hensarling proposed having a five-member commission to run the Bureau, where no more than three could be from any one party, a part of a bill that he called the Choice Act. Just a few days ago, Chairman Hensarling in this Congress, because you have to reintroduce a bill once one Congress ends, all the legislation that was not acted upon by the previous Congress disappears or dies, and you have to start all over. He's he introduced an outline of what he calls his Choice Act 2.0, or a variation on the legislation he was proposing last year. And one of the changes in the 2.0 version would be what he is talking about proposing for the structure of the Bureau. Under the Choice Act 2.0, there would be just a sole director for the Consumer Bureau, appointed by the president, but it would be someone who could be removable at will by the president, and also there would be a deputy director appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate, but who could also be removed by the president. And he would also propose that the Bureau's supervisory responsibilities would end. Currently, the Bureau supervises all banks of $10 billion in assets and above, but does not supervise any banks smaller than that. So community banks are not supervised by the Bureau, but they are governed by the rules that the Bureau makes. All of the supervisory responsibility for the Bureau under this legislation would be passed on to the bank regulators, and the controversial UDAP authority, the authority for the Bureau to bring enforcement actions against practices that it considers to be unfair, deceptive, or abusive, that authority would be removed from the Bureau. The new condition of abusive would be removed from the statute, and UDAP authority would be passed back to the FTC, where it has been for a long time. So we have really a very interesting mix of different views of how to structure the Bureau, at least on the part of Congress, making the situation of the Bureau even murkier than it was before. Back to you, Jerry.
Thank you, Wayne. Wayne, I wanted to talk for a couple of minutes about something that one of our loyal listeners, Rich Samp at the Washington Legal Foundation, brought to my attention. And this is an interesting matter. There is a petition for cert pending before the U.S. Supreme Court right now in a case involving the CFPB, a case that the CFPB won in the Ninth Circuit. It's called Gordon versus CFPB. And the background on it is this. Those who've been a student of the CFPB will remember some of this history, but the director, Richard Cordray, was originally appointed by President Obama as a, quote, recess appointment, unquote, in January 2012. On the same day that he also appointed members of the National Labor Relations Board, also as recess appointments, on the theory that the Senate was in recess because it wasn't in session at the time. 6 months later, 5 months later, in June of that year, 2012, the CFPB brought this action against Mr. Gordon. Ultimately, if you remember your history correctly, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the National Labor Relations Board appointments were invalid because the Senate was in session, and so therefore was not in recess, and so the president did not have the authority to make those recess appointments. And obviously, one consequence of that decision was that the other appointment that was made that day, Director Cordray's appointment, suddenly became very, very questionable. Eventually, a deal was reached, and in July of 2013, more than a year after the Gordon case was brought by the CFPB, Director Cordray was finally appointed and confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Shortly thereafter, in August of 2013, Director Cordray issued a four-sentence notice published in the Federal Register ratifying all of the actions that he had taken prior to, or that the CFPB had taken prior to his July 2013 appointment and confirmation, which theoretically, arguably, ratified the enforcement action against Mr. Gordon. Well, Mr. Gordon argues, and this is very interesting, that an agency may not lawfully ratify earlier actions that were invalid, number one. And he also argues that the CFPB did not have standing back in June 2012 when it sued Mr. Gordon because it didn't have a validly appointed director who is directing these actions. So if I understand the situation correctly, the Solicitor General is considering whether to oppose the petition for cert or not, and the Washington Legal Foundation is hoping that at the very least it will not oppose the petition for cert, but possibly it might actually support the petition for cert here. So that is an interesting development, I think, and thank you to Rich for bringing that to my attention so we could mention it. Wayne, I don't know if we have time to keep going or not, or whether, and if so, I can keep going a little bit, or if we can stop for questions, whatever your druthers are.
I would suggest at this point, since we put a lot of things on the table, why don't we pause and see if there are any questions, people listening in. And if there aren't at that moment, then certainly we can turn to another issue or two.
Okay.
Great. Let's go to questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions while we wait for the first one to queue up, I'll ask one of my own. Wayne, what do you think President Trump will do with the CFPB and its director?
Well, this is a very interesting thing. It's part of a process of trying to read between the lines of the few things that you hear the administration saying or administration representatives. There's no doubt about that the administration is uncomfortable with Director Cordray serving in that position that he's at the Consumer Bureau. I think there's some concern about the Bureau and how it's structured, but also some concern about Director Cordray and the policies that he's pursuing, which seem to be more in tune with the previous administration than they are with the current one. But also, it's not entirely clear what they intend to do about Cordray there. There's some we believe and understand who think that even under existing law, that there have been enough errors and problems in the administration of the Bureau by Director Cordray and his team there that a finding of for-cause dismissal could succeed. That's one thought. Another thought is, well, he doesn't need to. The Consumer Bureau is part of the executive branch, and President Trump is the head of the executive branch, and he should go ahead and just determine that I'm the president. All the executive branch agencies are part of the executive branch in my administration, and I want somebody else in this spot, and send Mr. Cordray packing. There's some concern, however, that if Director Cordray has some political ambitions, and there's some rumors that he might be interested in going back to Ohio, his home state, and perhaps running for governor. The current governor's term expires there in 2018. And were he to be dismissed, does that create some kind of political cause for Director Cordray, should he decide to do that? All of those things, I think, are being considered, looked at, and are in the mix. In the meantime, the clock keeps ticking. The term of Director Cordray, if you measure it from the point where he was approved by the Senate and then sworn in by the President, expires in 2018. And there's some consideration that, well, he's going to be leaving in 2018, just wait for that to happen. One other thing I'll point out, though, and that is that as we're looking at all of the financial agencies and how you have a changing of the guard related to the changing of the presidency, one of those agencies is the FDIC. The FDIC has 5 members, and by law, no more than 3 of those members can be of any one political party. Currently, there are 3 Democrats on the FDIC board and 1 Republican, actually 1 non-party, nonpartisan. The chairman, Director Gruenberg, or Chairman Gruenberg of the FDIC, is one of those. The other is Director Cordray, and the other is the Comptroller of the Currency, Tom Curry. If the administration, Republican administration, wants to have a majority on the FDIC board after Chairman Gruenberg's term expires, which is scheduled to expire this fall, then they have to decide which of those 3 positions do they want to have Republicans sitting in. Presumably they would want the chairman of the FDIC to be Republican. They would want the comptroller of the currency to be a Republican. They would want the director of the Bureau to be a Republican. But if they use one of those Republican slots for something other than the Bureau, then they would not be able to put a Republican in that position. So I, by my looking at the different tea leaves and all, it suggests to me that by the fall at some point, should the administration decide they want to have a Republican majority running the FDIC, they will need to decide at that point what to do with Cordray, because they will need that spot for a Republican on the FDIC board.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Just a quick announcement, our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, April 19th. That call will feature a discussion of the Supreme Court case Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia v. Comer. That call will feature Ilya Shapiro, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute, and Hannah C. Smith, Senior Counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, is there anything else you two would like to discuss?
Jared, I was wondering if you wanted to talk about the letter from Congressman Cleaver. I thought that was a very interesting letter regarding fintech.
Yes, let me mention that. Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver, a Democrat from Missouri, wrote the CFPB on March 15th, citing a Harvard Business School study that suggests that algorithms used by financial technology firms to determine whether to grant a loan to a loan applicant or not discriminate against minority-owned small businesses. And this comes in the context of Section 1071 of the Dodd-Frank Act, which literally requires lenders to collect data on the race, sex, etc., of owners of small businesses who borrow money. Once the CFPB adopts a regulation implementing that statute. So that statute's been on the books now for 7 years, and the CFPB has not adopted a regulation implementing it yet, and so Congressman Cleaver asks the CFPB, when will it adopt a rule to implement that statute imposing this data collection obligation on small business lenders? And I have to go back to a moment just so people understand the significance of that. Wayne spoke about Home Mortgage Disclosure Act disclosure. I'm sure I'm not going to get this correct, but that is an enormously burdensome data collection effort. In other words, residential mortgage lenders are required to take data on race, sex, et cetera, of applicants for home mortgage loans. And I want to say there's at least 37, there may be 87 fields of data required to be reported on each loan applicant. Invariably, the banks with the best of intentions to try to complete this information invariably have errors in the information that has to have to be corrected. The CFPB has gone after banks that filed erroneous information, but no matter how hard one tries, errors creep into this effort. And to think that, well, now we're going to turn that data collection burden onto people who make loans to small businesses would not bode well, I think, for small businesses in this country, but it may be coming. Wayne, you may have some stronger views than I have on that subject.
Well, I think it's a particularly difficult thing because it's one thing to identify the race, ethnicity, gender, and so forth of an individual. How do you figure that out for a business? Some cases, sure, it's clear business, sole proprietorship, but in many cases, there are multiple participants in the business. The owners of the business may be a variety of different individuals or maybe another business that owns that business. Very difficult to identify who the people are, what the definition might be with regard to race, gender, ethnicity, and so forth. And then you get into difficult things, understanding that when you're dealing with individual consumers, those products tend to be very similar. I mean, you have some variety in mortgages and so forth, but they're more similar than they are different. It's hard to find two or three business loans that are the same. Because businesses are very different. And so gathering those kind of data, you are significantly increasing the likelihood, at the very least, of errors but also increasing the likelihood of misunderstanding and misinterpretation.
Mm-hmm. And actually, as I think about it, based on what you said, standardization. Can't you just see the CFPB pushing for standardized terms and conditions so that all the reporting is comparable and that kind of thing?
And what standardization does, it affects if you're the consumer. If you're a standard consumer or a standard businessman, it works great for you. But most people really aren't standard businessmen or businesses or individuals. And in addition, to the extent you standardize things, you decrease the opportunity to customize your financial service to meet the needs of your customer. Yeah. And that's the bread and butter of community banks. What a community bank is able to do, particularly its competitive advantage, is the ability to standardize its loans for the local community, the local businessmen, and so forth. When you're standardizing things, you play to the advantage of those who make their money by volume. And those, of course, are the larger operators.
Interesting. Wayne, what about the complaint database? Don't you have something to talk about there?
Well, I do, yeah. I mean, you certainly served up some good information on that. I'm happy to talk about that, and then let's see if there's some more questions. The Bureau every month publishes its complaint report or its database on complaints that were received for the previous month. And so on March 31, the Bureau published its report of data from, in this case, December through February of 2017. The top three categories for complaints during that period were debt collection first, credit reporting, and then mortgages. In fact, amongst those three, that comprised 62% of the complaints that were submitted in February. And debt collection was 30% of all of the complaints, just debt collection alone. Interesting is some of the other data, as you dig around into it, student loan complaints were up by 429% from the year-ago period, but that was largely attributable to the fact that up until a while ago, the Bureau only collected complaints with regard to private student loan servicing. But they expanded that to include federal student loan servicing, and when they did that, the number of complaints skyrocketed by 429%. But it's not a steady line. It also, the data point out, that number was down by 51% from the amount that they had in January. And then the last point that I would raise with regard to the report on complaints is that complaints for payday loans had the largest decrease, down by 28% during that period of time. Very interesting things. I guess you can make your own conclusions about what all that means, but the data are interesting. Are there any questions from our callers at this point?
Yes, there are. So let's go to our first caller.
Great. Caller, go ahead.
Hi. There's been a rash of demand letters sent from plaintiff law firms to financial institutions around the country alleging discrimination against people with disabilities under the Americans with Disabilities Act. I'm not aware that the CFPB or any of the federal banking agencies have taken a stance on this. I was just curious if you were aware of any guidance or any official stance that the CFPB has taken on this issue.
I'm not aware of any actions or position by the Bureau. Jerry, are you?
No, not at all. It's the first I've heard of that. That's interesting.
I do know that there's some effort to get the Department of Justice to give some guidance as to what are violations. These are things under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the argument, I think, being that some of the websites are not as accessible to people who may be visually impaired or have other disabilities that make it difficult for them to use websites. And I know that certainly a number of these cases have been going forward. The number seems to be trailing off a little bit because it seems to be a few boutique law firms that are raising these cases, and some of them they're trying to raise the cases in states where they're not licensed to practice. And once institutions have discovered that, they've been saying, who are you and where are you from and what gives you the right to raise a case against me here in my state? And some of the state attorneys general are reinforcing those points. But more to come. I think the problem is resolved when Department of Justice sets up some actual standards. There are no standards here for what the websites are supposed to be like, and the Department of Justice so far has not issued any guidelines. But nevertheless, there is a private right of action. And so in lieu of Justice Department guidelines, these issues get placed in the hands of the courts.
Great. Let's go to the next caller.
Caller, go ahead. Go ahead and state your question.
Yeah, I kind of jumped in late, and I heard you guys discussing the leadership structure of the Bureau. And
oh, you missed the best part. You missed Jerry's stuff. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry. I was curious. You discussed like the general pros and cons of the individuals outlaying their ideas for that. But I was curious as to if there was any other political appetite for modifying the enacting statute of like Dodd-Frank, because I think that was something that the president talked about, but I see that as maybe a little bit more of a political challenge for the House and the Senate. But I didn't know if you guys knew of anything in that vein.
Well, it looks like the House would have enough votes to pass some kind of restructuring of the leadership organization of the Bureau. I think the votes are there to do that. Might not get very many Democrat votes for that, but the Republicans have enough of a majority, and you only need a majority to enact legislation like that in the House of Representatives. In the Senate, Senate Democrats, to some degree, tried to make that what they would call a third rail issue. No changes to the structure of the Bureau at all. But I will point out there are some Democrats who are thinking, do we really want to have a Republican czar running the Bureau for a period of time, who might undo all the things that Director Cordray, the appointee of a Democrat president, has done. And there's some concern that maybe a commission or some other comparable structure might be the thing to do. It's not clear, though, at this point, where votes might be in the Senate on that. And to make any change like that, you'd probably need to be able to overcome a filibuster, meaning some 60 votes. To make a change of that nature, could it be done? Conceivably, but at this point, I could not tell you where the Democrat votes would come for that kind of a change.
Let's make another call for questions. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing anyone right now. I'll make another brief announcement. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org, and also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. I'll make a final call for questions. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Would either of you like to add anything or make any final remarks?
Not I.
Go ahead.
No, not I. I have nothing. Thanks.
Well, I would just add that fortunately or unfortunately, the Consumer Bureau will continue to provide plenty of things for us to talk about each month. It certainly is a very significant agency affecting all of us, and if you're in the financial services business, affecting your customers. And of all of the different financial agencies, its situation is the one that's most cloudy at the moment, and yet in many ways perhaps one of the most portentous for change for our financial system going forward. So definitely plenty for us to talk about now and in the days to come.
Amen.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I would like to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.